somehow, you know, it's comforting to know that there is an Uncle Sam laxative. And it's only 110 calories a serving. Somehow, you know, that'll make you feel bad. Uncle Sam laxative. And there's a picture on the Uncle Sam laxative box of old Uncle himself looking out there wearing his tall silk hat, Ed, red, white, and blue. And he's got a satisfied look on his face. Well, like my old Uncle Fred used to say, there's nothing like... what he said, there's nothing... I can't remember what it was he used to say. There's nothing like a good... Well, for the disposition, I can't remember exactly... I just got to sing this from the beginning, Ed. I just can't. I can't remember what it was that old Uncle Fred used to say. He said there was something, Ed, that was... Hold it there. Hold it now. Just a minute there. He said, it's bugging me already. Here it is, only Saturday. Just coming up over the horizon. I'm already... He said it was... something was great. He says, there's nothing like a good... What was it for your disposition? I can't remember. Well, we I'm the sheik of Araby. Oh, your love belongs to me. At night when you're asleep, into your tent I'll creep. The stars that shine above will light our way to love. You'll rule this land with me. Oh, I'm the sheep of Araby. Come on, gang, let's go. Araby. Your love belongs to me. At night when you're asleep. Your tent, baby, I'll creep, 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 creep. The stars that shine above, quack, quack, the light, your way to love. Quack, 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 you'll rule this land with me. Papa, racka, taka, taka, I'm a sheik. I'm a sheik, a sheik, a sheik, I'm a bee. That's terrible. Oh, boy, that's worse. Can't remember what it was. Oh, it's for the benefit of those of you who are interested in cultural events, I noticed that a New Jersey museum known as the New Jersey Historical Society is having a tremendous display, and it covers 100 years of progress, an enormous display of panties. This is very cultural, very historical. Gee, it's getting worse and worse. You ever had the feeling it is getting worse and worse? You know, speaking of getting worse and worse, all over the world, if you think guys are plotting and fighting it out on Madison Avenue and on Lexington Avenue and on Greenwich and Barrow Street and McDougal Street, they're fighting it out everywhere. You got that Italian music for me in there, Eddie? That Italian stuff? All right, come on, let's go. Come on, let's get it go there. Over. Play that again. Listen to that pregnant pause in there. It just says things right up and down your old short ribs. Listen. Boy, isn't that fantastic? I mean, when you're in, you know, you're in the bathtub and the water's coming down, you're taking a shower. These are the little things that make the difference, you know. The beat, the tempo, the timing of life. Seriously, now, if that clown had just come belting right in there, it wouldn't have meant anything. Listen to this now. Just seriously, listen to this. Now, listen to this now. Fantastic. Now, listen now. The scene in Rome's Anagrafi, the main government registry, was enough to make any bureaucrat blench. Scattered over the floor were 3,000 forms, giving the vital statistics of all the local Italian citizens. Some had been made into little paper houses. Others, strewn around in intricate patterns, a trail of little paper houses led up the steps from the filing room. It looks like a child's game on the beach. A baffled night watchman reported. Bafflement grew when 2 weeks later the headquarters of Rome's Automobile Club, where citizens endure lengthy and complicated procedures to obtain a driver's license, sometimes up to 3 weeks, were raided, and thousands of forms were dumped on the floor and then arranged in abstract Picasso-like designs, spelling out interesting Italian words. An anonymous phone call alerted the police. "Who's a talking?" asked the startled policeman. The sergeant, "Someone who hates a bureaucracy." The voice answered. While the Romans cheered from the sidelines, the phantom enemy of Italian red tape struck again and again. And last week, in a daring cat burglar raid on the registry of Rome's Garabatella district. Wow! This time, the phantom who had scaled the wall slipped in through a second-story terrace, reached the main archives, and then made paper airplanes out of all the index cards. Playfully he sailed them on top of filing cabinets, under desks, and down long corridors to show how he had entered the building. He left a trail of white forms all the way down to the street. Summing up the views and secret wishes of citizens chuckling over their Camparis, Rome's Il Messaggero commented, "Undoubtedly many will strike the enemy of bureaucracy, hopes that they will strike next." Many Romans obviously hope he will strike next at the tax office. If that maniac, retorted Tax Bureau Director Enzo Ferrari, reported, "we'll grab him in 2 seconds. We're wired for radar and have an amplifying machine. Every squeak and sound is heard by a man on a duty all night long. If that maniac breaks into the tax office, he is a dead man." But when Newsweek asked City Hall whether Rome's mayor, Professor Glauco della Porta, feared that the one-man revolt might spread, a bureaucrat replied, "Any questions must be submitted in writing and in duplicate." All together now, gang. Help it out. Bring it up from your gut. Oh, here we go now. This is where it gets big. All right, that's enough of that. Come on, fellas. Come on, gang. You can't get these. Once you get an Italian started, you've got trouble. All right, gang. I got ahead of you. You know, the funny thing, I remember, I don't... Let's get some of these commercials out of the way. The first thing we have here is show. And speaking of opera, as long as we have opera here, for crying out loud, Das Rheingold, starring Kirsten Flagstad, George London, John Midiera, and Svet Svanholm. Das Rheingold, maidens and maidens, tomorrow on WOR's recorded opera at 2. We have show with us tonight, speaking of showbiz, and they have a lot of stuff this month. And they would like to point out that they have a special thing about bunnies in the Playboy clubs. I'm sure that all of you intellectual types will be interested in that. And then a searching, deep, probing profile of Japan, the new Far West. So they've covered the thing there, the gamut. That show this month on your newsstand. Speaking of gamut, I think gamut, which is an excellent word, it's G-A-M-U-T, gamut, that's a great word to describe life itself. Well, has anybody out there got a definition of gamut? Do you have a definition? Do you have a dictionary in the gamut? Gamut. Speaking of running the gauntlet, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York, and we'll be here until 1. No, midnight it is now, yeah. We have with us here Mandarin House. Oh, hey, listen. I put on the thing tonight up at Mandarin House on 2nd Avenue, just off of 57th Street. It's about three doors north of 57th on 2nd. And let me tell you one thing. Every time I go to the Mandarin House, this is Mandarin food, I order something different. And tonight I had twice cooked pork. If you go to one of the Mandarin houses, please select twice cooked pork. Try it if you like hot, spicy food. And this is Mandarin House. And do you know that you can eat at the Mandarin House? If you were to eat every night at the Mandarin House, you could eat for over 400 days without repeating a menu. It's insane. Yeah, 400 days. We were counting it up tonight. And one more thing. There is a wild article on Emily Kuo in tonight's World Telegram. Great big article. This is Emily. Yeah. And they have a bar. All right? They're open on the weekend. All right. Now, let's see. We also have Jules Pfeiffer's new book, Hold Me. No. It's a very funny book. And for you Pfeiffer fans, you should know that there is a new Pfeiffer collection out called Hold Me, which is a very, it's a very nervous book. And it's one of the very few books that enjoys being petted. And if you like to just hold things, you know, a lot of people just walk around town holding books and carrying them in the back pocket of their chinos. Well, this is a book that's designed for that. It bends in the middle, and it's soft. And it's a very nervous book and likes to be just held and petted. So if you don't like to read books, Hold Me is perfect for you. You can look at it in a minute and a half, but it's very funny. Hold Me, Jules Pfeiffer, Random House, $1.95, and you can pick it up at your favorite bookstore. And let's... Oh, yeah. Now, speaking of... Have you got my favorite tenor up there, Ed? No, that's all right, then. I'd kind of like to have him again. Yes, he is irrepressible. Will you please get that guy out there? If you can, Eddie. Come on, quickly, baby. On the same side, Ed, two cuts before, there is the same guy belting out an even funnier one. Pagliacci, you got it in there? Huh? Oh, this is... I'll tell you, there isn't one of us that doesn't have an insane desire inside of us. There's something about operatic singing. Look, come on, bring it up again. Come on, Ed.
Tu sei pagliaccio.
Oh, that's wonderful. See, I'm the villain, you see. Now, I'll tell you what I'm playing here in this scene now. Now, put it back up there. He is playing the heroic tenor. And I am playing the sinister baritone, whom he has just discovered making love to the count's wife, the Countess della Chiesa Forza. and I have been making love to her clandestinely on the castle's ramparts. Now, I draw out my dagger, and he is now threatening me. See, I'm laughing sinisterly now, and I'm standing with my dagger held up ready. Very good. You see? Now, it's very simple. If you get yourself... I'm sorry. I'll never forget one thing, though, that I don't know whether any of you remember this. I will award a brass figligi to anybody with bronze oak leaf palm who was at a certain very nearby military installation when this occurred. I happened to be there. And they brought in a large raggle-taggle collection of Italian prisoners of war. Now, that was a very interesting experience because... Now, the Italians will argue this back and forth and up and down and sideways, but the Italians were just not in it during World War II. Now, they're going to argue, and there's going to be a lot of guys call in, but history will not bear you out, fellows. In fact, I knew an Italian pursuit pilot who told me a very funny story. One day, I'm standing on the beach here a couple of years ago at Anzio, and we're standing there, and I'm with this friend of mine who, as I said, was a Fiat pilot. And he was stationed near Rome. Anzio is just outside of Rome. And he was stationed near Anzio at that point. And there was an airfield there. And I'd never talked about this to him, see? And he says, look out there. And I looked out, and he's pointing out over the water. And the beautiful day, and the sun is coming down, and you could see the water rippling in the... It's just lovely there. It's just a beautiful place. And you could see that sun hitting the Mediterranean and just spring, just lovely, lovely afternoon. And we're looking out, and he says, you see that point out there? And I said, yes. He said, well, you'll never forget one day when a bunch of British planes came over, and they alerted him. And he said, all of us jumped into our planes. He said, and I started to take off on the runway. And he says, I got about the 50 feet in the air, and no tail in the airplane. And into the water I go, just like that. Boom, splash. He says, I go into water. Well, he was just taken off, and they shot the tail of his airplane off. So he's in the water. He gets out of the water. He swims around. His plane sinks. And he swims all the way back in. He says, I swim into the point. And the commandant, they say, get in the airplane, Federico. And I run over, and I jump into another airplane. This is a true story. He jumps into another airplane. He says, I take off down the runway, and this time I get up in the air. I go up, 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 up. I make a turn. They shoot off a wing. Down into the water I go. Into the water he goes. He said he was shot down in less than a minute. He was shot down twice. He says, so then he swims to the shore, and he was happy. He says, I'm happy all the way. They are telling, if you are shot down, you'll get sent up to Milano on a leave, 1 month leave for getting shot down. I am happy. I am swimming in. I am going up to Milano for 1 month of vacation. I get on the runway, and the commandator says, Federico, into the airplane. They are coming. I jump in the airplane. Up I go. Down I go again. Three times. One, two, three times. Oh, in the water I go, I swim. Well, he says he swam all the way back. And he says the only reason that they didn't send him up the fourth time was that the plane that he had just been shot down in was the last airplane they had for 45 miles around. Anyway, I was at this place. I'll have to tell you the story. It was kind of a funny thing. The war was going full tilt, and suddenly they brought in this bunch of raggle-taggle Italian prisoners. Well, the first thing that knocked us all out about them were that they were all about at least a foot and a half shorter than we were. it seems like they had raided all the elves and had brought a whole bunch of elves in or something, and all these little fellows were running around, and I don't know, it must have been a special, maybe two or three battalions of little guys that they had gotten from someplace in Italy. I never saw anything like it. And they came in, and of course all the GIs were fascinated by this. We're all standing around looking at them, and they had these strange colored uniforms. They have an odd sort of uniform. The Italian uniform looks like it was left out in the rain too long. All their uniforms look like they were another color before, even when they're new. So these guys are all being brought in, and we're all standing around looking at them. Well, for some reason or other, it was very difficult to get mad at them. They were just sort of walking along, a whole bunch of them. There must have been about 150 of them in the bunch, and guys are saying, "Oh, Tavolo, Malta Guzzi!" They're hollering at them, and these guys saying nothing. You know, they're sort of shuffling in. And they put him into barracks. Well, apparently the official attitude was very much the same, because they put these guys into barracks, and about 3 days later, it was the darndest thing you ever saw in your life. All the Italians had come out of their barracks. It was wild. And they had made every barrack. Now, remember, this is in a GI camp, very GI. Everything is absolutely square corners, nothing but gravel, you know, Ed. And they have little ditches by the side of the road and dirt around. Everything is trampled down. There's nothing. No, there is not one bit of decor anywhere around, except maybe a flag somewhere. Well, these Italians had taken all the rocks that they could find on the ground and had painted them white. They had gotten somewhere, they had gotten some whitewash, and they built little fences around the barracks where they put them, out of stones. And then they built rock gardens. And they were all out building rock gardens, and these guys not only built rock gardens, they put hearts out there in rocks, you know. They had hearts. It was typical. All of a sudden, it was right back in Jersey, you know, out in the front of the houses with the hearts and the stone deer and the rubber Mexicans and all of it. They had hearts and flowers. They had little Madonnas they built out of the rocks, and it was all out there in front of their barracks. It was a very wild scene. Uh-oh. A bulletin here? Go ahead, Ed.
There's a bulletin just in from the WOR newsroom, dateline Salt Lake City. Federal aviation officers reported two military planes, one a bomber and the other a tanker, collided during a mid-air refueling exercise shortly before 11 p.m. tonight near West Yellowstone, Montana. No further details are available as of this hour. Stay tuned here to WOR Radio. We'll keep you posted. Now back to Gene Shepard.
You know, I'll tell you, thank you, folks. There's a very, very, very odd thing about what this did to us as we're walking around there. You see, we were being trained, at least at that point. These guys had just been brought in from North Africa, and we were all being trained, very hard-bitten type guys, and suddenly to see all these guys walking around with little hearts and flowers in front of their barracks, you know. It was very demoralizing, and once in a while somebody tried to get mad. Well, on Sunday, now, I wonder if anybody who's listening was witness to this. It was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. On Sunday, they let all the Italian prisoners just walk around. They walked all around, just like all the rest of the GIs. And they gave them funny sort of uniforms with a big orange thing around the side of their arms so that you could identify the Italians. Of course, you could identify the Italians from a mile away. Because they walked funny and everything. They didn't walk like soldiers or anything. And you would go into the PX, and there'd be about, or like 150 GIs standing there, great big lunks from the Midwest, scratching and hollering. And scurrying around would be about 17 or 18 little Italian GIs with their orange things on there. Now, I don't know where, they must have gotten Red Cross packages or something, because they gave them little certificates that they could trade in for Milky Way bars. Well, these Italians are in there trading Milky Way bars, and everybody sort of, you know, nobody quite knew how to feel that, you know, we didn't know quite how, because after all, you know, this is the enemy, and they're fooling around the PX, you gotta go, yeah, enemy, you go and hit one on the face, and he's a little guy, weighs 105 pounds, and he's standing there real sad. Well, then, the word got out, apparently, all over Jersey, among the Italians, that there were some Italian prisoners in this camp. Because every Sunday, this is what would happen. There would be 45,000 Italians outside the gates all along the fence. They had wire fences, and all the Italian GIs would be lined up inside looking at you. Come on, you'd hear these guys yelling back and forth, and there were, you never saw more Italian chicks from Jersey in your life standing outside the gates talking to the Italian GIs, who obviously they didn't know. They were just Italians. See? And they were handing stuff back and forth, bread and so on. And within weeks, it was a wild scene, within weeks, apparently somebody had smuggled in like 94,000 pounds of geranium seeds from the outside Italians, because apparently no Italian is happy unless he has geraniums growing somewhere. Well, around the front of the barracks were all these guys. You never saw, because all the rest of the camp was very official, and you saw about seven barracks that had geraniums all around them, geraniums and hearts and flowers and little Madonnas, and you could hear all night long, you could hear these guys hollering and singing. I must say that from those days on until the times that I spent in Italy after that, I formed a great and lasting and abiding affection for the Italians, which is very difficult to explain. It is a thing which you cannot quite transmit. You know, speaking of the abiding affection, it's a funny thing. I was standing. One of the sad kind of things that I saw along that line was right outside of Rome. As a matter of fact, in Rome, there is a tremendous park and a kind of a sports arena and so on that was built under Mussolini. And they have around the edge of this thing the wildest statues you ever saw. Terrible art. It's the worst kind of Norman Rockwell type art, but it's heroic art is all right, but when heroic art gets phony, oh boy, there's nothing phonier than heroic art. Now, heroic art is something you don't see often here in America, but heroic art is statue art. You know, you've seen these generals in the park, you know, with the gigantic bulging muscles. They even got muscles behind their ears, you know, the tremendous thing. And their horses look like no horses you ever saw. Great big muscular, big teeth, eyeballs bulging. Well, you know, this is heroic art. Well, you should have seen the Italian heroic art, which they put up during the time of Mussolini. And it showed all these various heroic people. This is one of the things that is fascinating about dictatorships. Art immediately goes into a nosedive. Oh, wow. Have you ever seen any of the heroic paintings of the Russians? Oy. They make this stuff that people do, you know, that they get from the Woolworths, where they paint it by the numbers. They make that stuff look abstract. I'm serious. They make that look like it's real deep stuff. Oh, boy. Well, these statues are all around there, and I'm spending the last day I was spending there at that time in Rome. I was sitting there with a girl, and the sun was coming out. It was just a magnificent day, and the birds were twittering, and all these statues were standing around us there. And there was they were just a long line of white statues. There was the heroic peasant girl. Looking up there, great big muscles, and she's got a big scythe, and she's getting ready to do whatever things do to the wheat, you know. And then it shows heroic scientist, and he's standing there looking off into the far distance with little nuclear things flying around him. This was all done, you see, during Mussolini. For some reason, well, they haven't taken that junk down. Well, then the biggest one of all, and the guy had these little shorts on, see. He was the tallest one. He was 37 and a half feet tall if he was an inch. A gigantic, it looked like he was made out of plaster Paris, a gigantic Italian soldier. Enormous muscles. He's got a great big gun and a big square jaw in his eyes. And all around me in the deck chairs were the same little Italians, which I had seen over at Monmouth, you know, all those skinny guys. And a great big statue was looking out there. Count the boys, bravissimo, I just thought that was kind of... It wasn't until I got home that I realized that the image of America to the average American is very different from what America really is. Which, just exactly, of course, it takes an outsider to see it. And it really does. And the Italian sitting there. And so I say to this girl, I said, that's quite a statue there. And she says, very good. And I said, well, do you know anybody like that? She says, no, but very good, the statue.
Yeah. I got to take off of the runway. I'm in the water now. I'm swimming in. I say, oh, very good. I go back to Milano now. 1 month in Milano, I get off. They shoot at me. Oh, boy. And don't think for 1 minute I'm making fun of the Italians. I dig them. I like that attitude. I'm very much for it. You know, speaking of war and the strange, sinister things that are going on, which are everywhere, there was an advertisement in Newsweek. No, Aviation Week. Aviation Week, which is a very official magazine. And it's one of the... Hey, you have my sinister wartime music up there, Eddie? That's it. All right, come on, let's go. Aviation Week, 22 April 1963. Engineered for global street fighting. Modicon 5. Ready to move on instant notice to anywhere in the world to counter aggression on enemy selected ground and under enemy prescribed conditions. Designed to assure mastery of the air situation with command and control of aerial operations and close support of ground forces. Engineered for first day capability, mixed weapons control, modular dispersibility. Compactly packaged for global mobility and air transportable shelters suitable for helicopter and vehicular operations. Fully researched and developed for rapid integration into special air warfare units. Engineers and scientists qualified to assume important assignments in advanced data handling and display systems will find a broad spectrum of challenging opportunities at Litton Systems. Engineered for global street fighting, Modicon 5. What is it? Wow. You know, another thing that we're doing that I kind of like, I mean, all over the world it's being done. Don't put that away, Ed. That's a good one. All over the world, we are beginning to develop new words to hide behind, words that somehow sound clean and antiseptic, that cover a multitude of wild things. For example, you've heard the word megakill. Have you heard that word? I mean, that doesn't sound as bad as 1 million people killed. You know, it doesn't. It's just a mega kill. And this is one of the, I think one of the sneakiest problems that we have with us today is this wild desire to cover up what we're really doing with all kinds of little bath mats of unreality. You know, little bath mats with little roses and hearts and flowers. I'd like to point out that this ad has what appears to be a Japanese woodcut illustrating it, see, with the little canes and beautiful little things there. And it's kind of like a fun thing. And some of these words are such great words because they really don't it's hard to know what they really mean. And when you think about what they really mean, by that time it's too late. The copy has gone past you. For example, let's say here's a good word here. I like this one. Modular dispersibility. It's a good word. It's specially designed for that, you know. That's a very good word. There's a lot of words. Anti-sub-aggression pact. Well, that's a very good one, too. You know what that means? That means if a guy just sort of kind of gets smart, that's sub-aggression. Oh, yeah, well, you see, you can have levels of aggression. Now, if a guy hits you in the eye, that's aggression. What are you going to do if he just turns his eye, all right, wise guy, flicks his eyebrow at you? What do you call that, then? You got to call that something, you know? You really do. Somehow, it reminds me of the time. Science, of course, is a thing. It's a real wild thing. I was reading today, where in one of the papers, where they were talking about the fact that all over town people have stopped drinking martinis, and now they're drinking straight gin on the rocks. See, And so they were asking why this was. You know, everybody was wondering why it was. And this far-seeing, hard-hitting philosopher says, well, of course, it's due to tension over the atom bomb. Do you know anybody who's tense over the atom bomb, Ed? We are using this just like people used to use all kinds of things like religion, earthquake, the great landslide, the avalanche. We're using these things to duck out. It couldn't be that people just don't like vermouth, you know? Couldn't be that. Couldn't possibly be, huh? Well, on the subject of things that couldn't be, do you know that, I was a kid, this stuck in my mind. It just stuck in my mind like a thing. I can't get rid of it. When they had the World's Fair, when I was a kid, out in Chicago, they had this big World's Fair. I'm looking forward to the opening of the New York World's Fair. I'm a great World's Fair fan. There's no question about it. But I'm afraid from the rundown of the various exhibits which I have seen already displayed about this World's Fair, it seems to me like it's going to be a gigantic public relations job. Yes, you know what I mean. Every building is designed to sell something, to package whatever it might be, whether it's the Billy Graham Crusade building or it could be the Russian Pavilion. It's all a gigantic whole series of packages designed. It's like enormous presentations where you get in there and the films are going and the guys are handing out pamphlets and the girls are walking around dressed like cowboys and all that stuff. Well, now the World's Fair was not always that way. Really, they weren't always that way. There was a lot of other things went on in World's Fairs. And one of the things that always is really spectacular about a World's Fair, Dave, is when they open it. Now, I don't know how they're going to open this World's Fair the first day. But when I was a kid, I'll tell you how they opened the World's Fair when I was a little thing. They did it with a star, yes. And when this star crossed a certain point, it was picked up by a photoelectric cell, and it kicked a lot of relays, and the World's Fair went on. Just like that, see? And everybody stood around and waited for it to happen. Well, you know, this was a gas. I mean, it's just a wild thing that the star turned on the World's Fair. And the star was named Arcturus, which has always been a great name for a star to me. Arcturus. And I remember one quote that just sticks in my mind like a little neon sign, a quote. A lady was asked about, you know, they had this inquiring reporter thing in the Chicago Tribune, and one lady made the comment, she says, isn't it amazing how the scientists know the names of all them stars? And it suddenly occurred to me, yeah, well, how do they know the name of all them stars? You know, wouldn't it be terrible to get up to Mars and find out that its name is Fred? You know, all these years, everybody's been talking about landing on Mars, and it turns out they're landing on Clarence. And you know, it would be very depressing. They have to radio, hey, it ain't Mars. This place is not Mars. We just have received the information that this place is named Clarence Seastrom. Clarence Seastrom is the name of this planet. And there are a lot of guys sitting around here who are fat and are drinking beer and they're watching television. The name of this place is Clarence Seastrom. So will you please put that on the 11 o'clock news with Ron Cochran, will you? Ladies and gentlemen, tonight our scientists landed on Mars, and the first thing they discovered was the name of the planet is Clarence L. Seastrom, and that there were many people sitting around watching television and were fat. Now, they were preparing to have a war, too, at the moment we landed. Now, their war, of course, was different in many ways from ours because they used old-fashioned... I'm sure that somewhere, 87 billion light years away, some guy is watching Earth, and he is planning to land on Trigon 7 someday. And he is hoping that when he gets to Trigon 7, there will be beings there, mysterious beings there, who have conquered love, who know all about how to get along with all other people, who know how to get rid of war, and have lived in peace forever and ever and ever, and have the secret of the universe, and the secret of all seeing humility and love, and who understand God perfectly. If only we could get to Trigon 5. Trigon 5 appears to have a livable, somewhat viscous atmosphere. There could be beings such as we know on Trigon 5. And some guy is in an attic somewhere, 87 billion light years away, writing a science fiction story about how these people on Trigon 5 understand each other by thought waves.
If only we could get the Trigon Five! Trigon Five! Trigon Five!
And there is an all-night radio program 87 billion light years away. Short Freddy is doing this five-hour radio program, and he's got six guys, one of whom claims that he was teleported to Trigon 5 and taken inside of a spaceship and shown how to live in beauty, humility, and love forever.
If only we could get the Trigon 5!
And then another guy is writing a movie 87 billion light years away called The Invaders from Trigon 5 with the giant stainless steel pincers that eat up people like rotten things.
Beware of Trigon 5!
The monster that swallowed the Bronx. You know, it's very funny how all them scientists know the names of all them stars, you know? I wonder how they know them. I wonder what this one, Saturn, that it could be almost any name, you know. Saturn, it could be almost any name. You get up to Jupiter? It could be almost anything. How do we know it's Jupiter? It's very funny. And Pluto. I remember one time on this kid, this lady says, we have discovered a planet way out somewhere. It's way out on the outer circle there, and nobody ever sees it. Just once in a while it shows up and looks very sad and then disappears into the darkness. Ever since that time, I've been a Pluto fan. That's the name of the planet there, Pluto. It's funny how they know that's Pluto, you know? Just shows up. Yeah. What'd you say I was a pain in, Mac?
This is W.